Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 195. We're getting close to 200, aren't we? People keep asking me if I'm doing anything special for 200. And I went to get some big names, and then I decided that that's not really what we do here. It's about everyone. It's about every episode. So at one point, there was going to be a huge name on episode 201. And that was intentional because I just didn't want him to be on episode 200. But yeah, I'm moving things around and working things. Trust me, in the next year, I've got three guests lined up. One is one of the previously most downloaded. One hasn't been on, but will probably be the biggest guest I've had on. So yeah, trust me, there's loads to come. But I'm thinking, it's basically us having to hold off to get a specific one on the 200th episode. But in this last week, I've recorded 7 podcasts in 6 days. So I'm recorded up until like June. So, and there's others that I have to record that need to go out on certain dates to help people promote gigs or films. So yeah, it's complicated. Speaking of which, next week's episode is a Hardcore Listing first birthday special. So Hardcore Listing is a podcast on the network, which I'm a fan of. It's top fives. And I thought, as it's their first birthday, I'd invite Chris and Stu onto Distraction Pieces to do a top five, and we recorded it last week, and I chose top five songs that make me cry, and they had to pick their top five, and honestly, we were genuinely struggling to talk. There's numerous points that we had to stop because we were crying too much. So it's a weird one, but I'm really proud of it, so I'm pleased. So yeah, anyway, that's to come. But this week's guest, good Lord, it's a good one. I was really lucky to get to sit down with Patrice Kallous, who's one of the co-starters or co-founders of Black Lives Matter. It's mad I got an hour with her. Just to put it in perspective, the people that she was talking to before me were BBC Breakfast on TV and Women's Hour on Radio 4, which is one of the biggest radio shows in the UK, and then was little old me, and then there was another I think an ITV thing at the South Bank after that. So it's mental that my little podcast is sneaking in with the big wigs, but I ain't saying shit. I'm keeping it quiet, just sneaking in under the radar. But it was an amazing chat, and she was an amazing woman. This is for people who support Black Lives Matter, but it's also for people who are confused by it, for people who maybe want to argue that all lives matter. I'll explain why that is a ridiculous statement with the greatest of respect. So yeah, I'm really pleased with this chat. Obviously, I need to mention that this week's podcast is brought to you by speechofelementrecords.com. That's my website and my record label where you can buy. We mentioned Bea Dolan in this, who did a song called Film the Police around the time of some of the shootings that were going on in America. And it was a huge one. It was a rewrite of Fuck the Police by NWA and turning it into Film the Police. And Bea Dolan's on the label is why I mentioned that. We've got his records in stock. We've got some T-shirts, I think. A load of stuff. But we've also got podcast merch. I've talked a few on a few recent podcasts. On next week's one, I talked to the Hardcore Listing Boys about Patreon. On last week's, I talked to Steve McNeil about Patreon. I don't do Patreon. I like to earn from the sponsorship. So you guys, primarily, again, I'm not against Patreon at all. That's why we talk about it in great detail on other podcasts, because it's right for certain ones and not right for others. I like that you guys, at the core, can have the podcast completely free. Sponsors are covering that. I'm not going to go bankrupt. It's fine. But I do kind of say, if you listen every week and you're getting, you know, an hour's entertainment every week for free, I've been doing this, I've not missed a week for over 3 years now, then you might want to sling some money on some merch and support. That'd be cool. But you don't have to. But you can go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com if you so choose. So back to this week's podcast. It's a cracking one. Patrice Kallous has a new book out called When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. And it's a fascinating book. It's really the story of her life. It punctuates a lot of the point along the way with some of the incidents that you'll associate with Black Lives Matter, so it's kind of, it's telling her life, but then a reference in stuff that happened down the line that caused her to start this movement. It also talks about what's ahead. She talks about the issue of policing the movement, of making sure that the right action is taken and the action is taken that represents those involved fairly and accurately. It's a special one. If you like this podcast, if this is your first time listening, I'd recommend you check out the Killer Mike episode from ages ago, because I talked to Killer Mike kind of in the midst of all this stuff happening and Black Lives Matter just starting to become a movement, and he was incredibly informative and intelligent on that. I've also had a refugee special about a young lady called Ramel, who was a refugee in the UK from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that's a really powerful episode, because it shows the restrictions that are put on people and what can be done when those restrictions are lifted, and the bias put upon certain people. So that's an interesting one. But also, in this week of recording tons of podcasts, the day after I recorded this, I recorded another podcast that's one of my favourite today. So these two, today's and this one, it's not going to be out for a few weeks, but it's a special one. And that one coming up, I think it's going to be out beginning of April, is with a lady called Alexis Okowo. I kept saying her name wrong. Anyway, Alexis Okowo. And she's a journalist who's written an amazing book called A Moonless, Starless Sky. And it's about kind of regular people in Africa fighting extremism day to day. And it's amazing. The podcast was, she was such a warm and comfortable talker, as was Patricia's, as you'll hear now. There's obviously, the name of the book suggests that there's a taboo around Black Lives Matter, that it's very militant and overly left and overly sensitive and overly screaming down the opposition. Not at all. She was one of the most warm, open to debate and discussion. I like that we take the conversation from the Black Panthers to Black Panther, and the importance of both over the years. So, yeah, it's a really good chat, and I'm really pleased with it. I'll be back at the end to round things up. I've got a future podcast. I've got Alan Hughes and Jimmy Iovine on. Alan Hughes is the director of the Defiant Ones documentary that's coming to Netflix in a few days, as this one comes out, actually. And it's fantastic. It's about Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre. And Jimmy worked with Springsteen, Lennon, Patti Smith, Tom Petty, and then started Interscope and signed Dre, Tupac, Snoop, Eminem, Marilyn Manson, Nine Inch Nails, No Doubt. It's insane. And Alan Hughes directed the Defiant Ones documentary, but he also directed Menace to Society, which is one of my favourite films and came at that period, kind of. So in 91, when there was the Rodney King beatings, and then 92, the riots that broke out as a reaction to that, and it kind of spawned NWO. And then there was all this spotlight on areas that hadn't had a spotlight before. And it was around that time that the Boys in the Hood came out, around 94, 95, so a few years later, the Boys in the Hood, A Menace to Society, and previously Do the Right Thing, all these amazing documentations of a culture that had been voiceless for a long while. So that's a cool one coming up. As said, the Alexis Okowo one is amazing. I've got Charlotte Hatherley coming up. I've got Cedric Bixler, Zavala, Jamali Maddox, who's done an amazing series called Hate Thy Neighbor, where he goes around kind of Louis Theroux style and talks to a lot of weird kind of right and left extremists. So yeah, check that out. And they're all coming soon. But now, this is episode 195 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Patricia Kaloors, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. I'm joined today by Patrice Couleurs, how are you today?
I'm doing great.
Are you looking after yourself in this insane run of media and press and promotion?
I'm doing much better. I think this time around, I've learned that I need to drink water.
Yeah.
I need to eat and get as much sleep as I possibly can. I think when Black Lives Matter first started and people started to have me go around the world and meet new folks and talk about the movement, I didn't do a very good job at taking care of myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's key. I mean, it's something I had noted as my last question, but as I arrived and was hearing of the schedule you're on, it is an important one, because when you dedicate your life, and I want to get into your early life and everything that led to Black Lives Matter, as well as obviously the movement itself, but when you dedicate yourself to something that is so important, it's really hard to make sure you're looking after yourself.
Yeah.
Rather than the sole focus being, well, the cause, because the cause is grander than any individual.
Yes.
But that's to the world, to your world, what has to be important is you as well. So
exactly.
How have you found balancing that over the years? Is that something you've had to learn to do? Or
I haven't found balance. And to be quite frank, I don't know if you can. I kind of see this position that I am in as the people's soldier. I've, some people decide to join the military. I decided to join the movement. And
yeah.
So in some ways, my duties are to be a messenger for this movement, to go across the globe if I need to, and to drop stuff if I need to show up for this.
Yeah.
But what I think I can do, and what I'm trying to do now, is, okay, this is my life. So when I am traveling and doing a bunch of stuff, what are the things that I need to do to keep myself healthy?
Yeah.
And it's challenging, right? Because if things were better in the world, I wouldn't have to work this hard.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So it's hard to assess how much I should be doing or shouldn't be doing. But what becomes really clear is what I'm focused on.
Yeah.
And when I'm focused on a particular mission or movement, then I put my all into that. And I try my best to, when I have my days off and my time off, spend it with my family,
yeah,
you know, friends. But it's hard. Like, I don't know if I believe that there's a such thing as work-life balance when you're in this work. I think you could do the best that you can do to make sure that you're healthy while you're doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you do to switch off in those downtime moments? Is it, as you said, engaging with family and friends? Is there films or music or things like that that are your kind of escape?
Yes. Believe it or not, I'm going to say it on this podcast, but I watch the Kardashians.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair.
I've been watching them for 14 years, so almost half of my life.
Yeah.
I've been on, can you believe they've been on air for 14 years?
That's mad, isn't it?
It's wild. And we can have a whole nother podcast conversation about the Kardashians. I have like a social political analysis about them and their
amazing
and their growth. But I watch them. I obviously watch anything that Shonda Rhimes does.
Yeah.
Yeah, Shonda Rhimes. And I spend time with my family. I do. I tickle my little kid who's 2 years old.
Amazing.
And I spend time with my partner. And I call friends. I'm in town for a couple days. Like, let's hang out.
Let's do something.
Exactly. Like, let's play and laugh and hang out. And so I'm much better now, because before I think I would rip and run, make myself exhausted on these trips, go home and just be completely depleted. And
yeah.
Not there for anybody.
Yeah. And that's key, because I think something that's key to your story is the moment of realization that what you are taught that the world is as a child isn't an easy thing to realize that there's difference outside of that.
Yes.
So having a 2 year old that you need to let know that the world can be this positive place and there are these opportunities. You obviously, you grew up in Los Angeles and it was in very much an area that wasn't really for settling as such. It was people, you know, moving in and out. So there was, it's hard to get an idea of community, I guess, in that kind of situation. A lot of people on the breadline doing what they can to pay the rent and then, you know, moving on and moving out. And that's kind of all you know at that point, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, the neighborhood I grew up in, I didn't realize it until I got older that they pushed us out of that neighborhood. Police pushed us out of that neighborhood. And when I go back, there's nobody that I grew up with that still lives there.
Wow.
Everybody has been gentrified out of that neighborhood. It's a completely different place.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to somebody about that. And they had said, you know, that part of the book really stood out for them because they were like, you know, I get to go back to my childhood home, my childhood neighborhood and see everybody there that I grew up with. You know, my parents still own the home. And I said, yeah, that's not how my life was. You know, it was, we knew that where we lived wasn't going to be for the long haul. Right?
Yeah.
We could be moved and shipped around and gentrified out and pushed out by police. And I think that changes you. It changes how you understand your place.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And even on the point of jobs, the fact that careers as such in those situations aren't something that you're kind of aware of as a thing, as a goal. You're generally you're working to pay the rent, right?
Exactly.
So you I think a positive upbringing for kids is to think there's a career ahead, whether that career is running a shop or running a charity or being a film star or being a Kardashian, you know, any of these things. But if all you ever know is, no, you work to pay to live here, and then when we can't do that, we move somewhere else, you don't ever get to see that there's a world outside of that circle, which can't be a positive way to grow up. Or it must be a tough way to grow up.
I think it is. And you wouldn't know any better. And I didn't know any better until I entered a new world. Until I entered a world that wasn't my own. And then I lived in really two different worlds. I lived in a mostly white middle-class world where I was shipped off to go to school.
Yeah.
And I lived in my community where it was completely neglected and over-policed. And what became interesting going back and forth to each neighborhood is I saw exactly what you're saying, which is whole groups of children being groomed to have careers.
Yeah.
And then I remember thinking, oh, I want that. You know, I want to think about what I'm going to do when I grow up. And as I got older and started going to school and, you know, I really, for my college years, I paid for my own college and, you know, got scholarships and loans and worked. And I remember my mother saying, and bless her, she wasn't trying to belittle me or she just didn't have a context, but she was like, why are you working so hard and going to school? Like, just go to work. Like, you don't, why school?
Yeah, yeah.
And just this totally different understanding of what's possible.
Yeah. That's, it's intriguing and amazing. I mean, the start in, and again, your book is very much, it's a memoir leading into the intrinsic parts of Black Lives Matters. But it really struck me that so much in your upbringing, these key influences and these key things that you're exposed to, I guess, the fact that in your neighborhood, some of the people that were doing neighborhood engagement, some of the rare, were Black Panthers and were the early activist influence in your life, I guess. So was that something that you realized at the time was inspiring or was a key thing, or was that just, oh, they're the guys that kind of try and help out in the community? And
yeah, I think
it was a breakfast for children, I noted down, which again, that's a great positive influence, particularly as history went on for a certain amount of time to demonize the Black Panthers and to paint them again, as similarly as Black Lives Matters has had, as some kind of terrorist or some kind of threat, which it all mirrors what came ahead.
Yeah. Well, what's so interesting about the free breakfast program, you're just a child, and so you're doing what you do. You know, there's no sort of explanation that, hey, this was the Panther that helped you be able to eat, you know, breakfast and lunch, but I remember that those meals sometimes were the only meals that we had as kids. And so when I would come to learn later in my life that the Panthers really created that foundation, I was so intrigued about activism and organizing, because what up until that point that had been taught to me is that organizers or activists, because I didn't even know the term organizer yet, were just protesting. That the Panthers Party in particular were an armed, organization. And it was so surfaced and so superficial that I couldn't even get a full grasp on what it even meant to have the Panther Party. And so my politicization becomes really critical, because I learn by the time, I'm 19, 20, and I joined my first civil rights organization called the Bus Riders Union, I would learn that, I can become an organizer as a career.
That could be an actual thing that you dedicate your life to and your time to. And it's for not only the betterment of yourself and what, again, you would have been brought up with, you just work to pay the bills, but for the betterment of your society, of a broader and wider society.
That's absolutely right. And that becomes at the center of really my life, organizing, activism. And the moment I realized that this is what I've been wanting to do, and now I can do it.
Yeah. What role did the police have when you were growing up? Because something that strikes me with Black Lives Matter in particular is it's highlighting, it seemed to the outside world, oh, look at all the horrible stuff that's suddenly happening. But from your book and just from looking through history, there wasn't this sudden new wave of police violence against black community. There was a sudden documentation of police violence. And it echoes to me the Rodney King beating, which you would have been, around 8 or 9 for, I think, in LA at that time. That happened, but almost to the exact things, the acquittal and all other things, mirrors the 64 riots in LA. It's just, at that point, the Rodney King beating was caught on this new thing called a camcorder.
Exactly.
And now we all happen to have camcorders in our pockets every day.
Exactly.
So so how were the police in seen in your community and seen as part of your society?
I mean, this is such a good point, because up until Black Lives Matter, in a lot of ways, I think white people thought black people were being hyperbolic.
Yeah, yeah.
That we were exaggerating, and that if we just, did less crimes, if we just were more cooperative, we wouldn't have so many negative experiences with law enforcement. Or I think some white people just thought we were lying.
Yeah.
And what the cell phone camera does, and what our movement does, is actually, unfortunately, and fortunately, brings this truth, this truth that black folks had to light around the impact policing had on us. And so in my neighborhood, the police were terrifying. We were terrified of law enforcement, all of us, from my mother to my grandmother to myself to my siblings to our neighbors. I mean, nobody was interested in the police coming into our neighborhood. And yet we also wanted to feel safe, right?
Of course.
And we also wanted to feel like we could be protected. But I remember being in the car and my mother saying, "The police are behind us. Don't look back. You don't want to attract attention."
Mm-hmm.
I remember watching my brothers be lined up against the alleyway and stop and frisk. And at this point, these are young boys, all under 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Being humiliated, being forced to lift their shirts up. And obviously all this is illegal.
Yeah.
Right?
This is
illegal, and we don't know our rights.
Of course.
And so every single day we are being poked, prodded. We are being terrorized.
Yeah.
And in Los Angeles, we use helicopters
for
policing. So it's not just the patrol. car that's circling the block every hour on the hour. It's also the helicopter that's in the sky. And it's almost like an intimidating factor, right? I remember some days wondering, there doesn't seem to be anything happening around here. So why is the helicopter police hovering over our apartment building? Yeah. And I would have come to find out, right, just because of documentation and politicization that, oh, yeah, this was purposeful, this way of police repression and creating a hostile environment for a community became a part of their tactics.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And the thing that struck me the most when reading about that kind of thing from your childhood in the book was how at the time – how run-of-the-mill it was. Like, how run-of-the-mill. It was that you don't know that something is... If that's all you know, you don't know that it's wrong. That you would see your brothers be frisked in an alleyway as 12, 13, 14-year-old kids.
Yes.
And then just come in the house, have dinner. It wouldn't even be a disgusting. It wouldn't be a, this has happened, this is outrageous. That was just, at that point, all you knew. So... you can see why there would be a fractured relationship with authority in those blue uniforms as such.
Exactly, absolutely.
So through your own drive and intelligence and wish to get out of or reach beyond your neighbourhood, as you touched upon, you got to go to a school in a largely white, a richer neighbourhood. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the most interesting conflicts and weird situations in the book, because you would think that the way you had been taught in your poor black neighbourhood would possibly have a negative effect on when you're then in your more well-off white neighbourhood.
Yeah.
But the real issue kind of came when you returned, mm-hmm. and what the way you were treated in your... the posh white school had a negative effect on your actions in the black school. Definitely. And the explanation, just being quite quick and brief with it, is in the white school, you'd smoke some weed every now and then. This was a thing. This wasn't a big deal. Yeah. And then when you went back to your poorer black school, you were frisked on the door. You were searched. There was security. Mm-hmm. And that's why you got, you know, arrested at the age of 12 or however old. And it's that weird thing of that's a direct example and proof that it's completely down to how people are treated based on their skin color rather than their actions.
Yes.
The argument, as you said earlier, that, well, if you're breaking the law, then you get, it's like, no, you were doing exactly the same as you were doing in the white neighborhood.
Except I was criminalized for it.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely right. And it, you know, children behave the way children will behave how they behave, and based off of the consequences, they will either stop or they'll continue doing what they're doing. But for me, you know, I was in this white school. The first people that introduced me to weed was white girls.
Yeah.
And I smoked weed with them, and I made a terrible assumption that I could do the same at the school, my neighborhood school.
Completely. So
when I went to summer school, I smoked some weed in the bathroom, like I had done at my own school. And I mean, I don't even know how these police officers found out. I don't know how the school found out. I think someone might have told. And the next thing I know, I'm in the classroom and a cop shows up, whispers in the teacher's ear. They call me to the front of class, they handcuff me, walk me down the hallway to the principal's office, search my bags, ask me if I have weed, that they heard that I've been smoking weed, blah, blah, blah. And I never did that again, but something else happened for me, which was, oh, this is why my brothers have been criminalized.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the environment they've been in that I haven't been in.
Yeah.
And that was illuminating.
Yeah, completely. And again, I mean, not to go too deep into the drug side of things, I've got two different podcasts on my network, and one of them is Say Why to Drugs, and it's a doctor talking about the realities of drugs, mm-hmm. and one of them is a Leap UK podcast, which is law enforcement against prohibition. But the fact is that, again, I think it was a stat that you had in the book, that 75% of drug users don't develop an addiction. Mm-hmm. And so to criminalize is a dangerous and scary thing. But part of the criminalization is, particularly in America, down to the prisons system. And that's something you talk about a fair bit in the book. And
yeah.
have had a lot of experience with your birth father going in and out of prison and that having a big impact on your life, and your brother going into prison and being criminalized and arrested. So what was the atmosphere of or the outlook of prison in your upbringing? It's kind of, in a lot of those communities and areas, almost seen as an inevitability mm-hmm. to a great percentage of people that you're going to end up in prison at some point. And in America in particular, it's slave labor. It's mm-hmm. a system that is used to help companies and productivity and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. And my neighborhood, it was just the assumption that most folks were going to end up in jail, maybe not spend the rest of the time there, but spend a bit of time there, that most folks were going to end up being arrested. I think by the time I was 14 years old, almost every young boy in my neighborhood had spent some time in juvenile hall.
Yeah.
Had been criminalized somehow, some way. And I was navigating what it meant to live in two different neighborhoods and what my role was in going to this white school and coming back to this, you know, poor working class neighborhood of color. And so that just becomes an interesting moment. And prisons and jails become the backdrop.
Yeah.
They become the place where I go visit on the weekends to see my brother. They're the place where I go visit my father, my friends. I've been to so many jails and prisons. They're the writing letters to a loved one inside jails or prison becomes the norm, creating fundraisers for people who have gone to prison so that they could get commissary. I mean, it literally becomes a backdrop to my childhood, my young adult life, and now my adult life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing as well, because there's so many layers kind of touched upon and explained on the impact of prison. There is the actual act of being in prison, and again, the horrendous treatment that your brother suffered and many people suffered. But then equally, what isn't often thought about is the fact that, particularly at that point, even most low-level jobs wouldn't employ someone who's been to prison. So even if you've only had this brief time in prison, that could be a life sentence as such, because it could mean you never get the chance to get the jobs to move on, to develop.
Yeah, and this is important, because you're not just locked out of jobs. You're locked out of pretty much almost every resource that could allow you to live a viable life.
Yeah, yeah.
You're locked out of housing. You're locked out of employment. You're locked out of being able to get scholarships to go to school.
Yeah.
Everything. You're sometimes locked out of voting.
Mm.
So what becomes a prison sentence also becomes a sentence in which you're locked out of the very resources that could allow for your and your family survival.
Yeah. So add in that to what we've previously discussed of the fact that you grow up in a society where you're generally seen that there's a good likelihood you're going to end up in prison. Mm-hmm. What hope is there to strive forward mm-hmm. if so early on you're kind of told in so many ways from so many angles, this is your life. You're going to exist here and then you're going to die and that's it. There's no impact. There's no change, you know?
Of course. It's important. You know, sometimes I think organizers are half crazy, because we're doing the type of work that's really an uphill battle.
Yeah.
And there are moments like November 8th when a 45 comes in the office, right? Or even I would talk about this country here in the UK, moments like when a Brexit happens.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're like, I cannot believe I'm living in this moment.
Mm.
Have we all gone mad?
Yeah.
And then I sort of pick myself up and realize, yes, there is a part of the population that is mad, But there's another population that is willing to fight. And there's another population that just needs to be organized into the fight. And so I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because Black Lives Matter created the opportunity for a new generation of Black leadership.
Yeah.
A new generation of Black leadership and our allies to shape the world differently. It is it's a humanizing project. It's also a project that's deeply steeped in the tradition of Black radical imagination.
Yeah.
Right? This Black Lives Matter is challenging us to imagine a different world for Black people, not just in the U.S., but across the globe. And it makes me think of what's happening here in the United Kingdom. You know, I go a lot of different places, and we often talk about the U.S., which makes sense. But I'm it's important for me to that I know what's happening to Black people in all the places that I go to. And I know that sure. here, Black folks have been dying in police custody.
Yeah.
For decades. I know that there's been, you know, up to 1,649 deaths in custody and zero convictions. And, and I know that Black, you know, youth are being excluded from schools. Similar to our Black students in the States are being tracked, through the school to prison pipeline. And so as I start to zoom in from nation to nation, I realize that wherever Black people are, anti-Black racism exists.
Yeah, yeah.
And wherever Black people are, we're suffering. We're suffering. And so this movement was developed to not just talk about Black Americans.
Yeah.
I challenge Black Americans often because I think we think that our struggles are the most important. they're not. We're part of a global fight.
Yeah.
We're part of a Black diaspora. And that to me is honorable. And that yeah. to me is powerful that I know that I can go to any city across the world and meet up with Black folks and say Black Lives Matter. And they know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's almost like what Wakanda has done for all of us.
Yeah, completely.
And so we have this language now. Where we, when we say Black Lives Matter, Black folks know, yes, they might not be politicized, yeah. you know, but they know, oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. How, I mean, let's go off on a brief tangent there with that. Cause I think how important do you think it is to have these topics also being discussed and tackled in art and culture, in films, in TV? Cause there is a certain amount of people who will join the fight and be on the front line or watch a documentary or listen to a speech about these things. But there's a lot more people who will go and watch a Marvel film.
Yes.
And the thing that struck me, I didn't speak out on it because as a white male, mm-hmm. it's a tough one, but I was getting frustrated in some of the lead up to Black Panther because people were talking a lot. And I understand it about having a Black inspirational figure like that. And my thought was, well, you know, Martin Luther King was pretty inspirational, and there's been a lot of real life inspirational yes, figures. But yeah. the thing that struck me when I went to see Black Panther was something that hadn't crossed my mind. Was I grew up in a place called Thurrock, which has been a stronghold in the past for UKIP and a lot of kind of quite right leaning political parties. And what I saw at the end of Black Panther when there was beautiful African music playing was young white kids dancing along to that African music. And that hadn't struck me, the importance of white children having Black figures as inspirational figures as
That's
well.
A good point. Yeah. That hadn't struck me either.
Because again, it's something that I felt most Black people I've ever known have always been taught about Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and these amazing forces. But not necessarily all the white kids I knew were taught about that. And that's the bit that caught me off guard. I was like, oh, shit, that is important. Yes. That makes it even more important because the race battle, the race problem is primarily a white problem. Yes. So it's going to take a solution from people of all colours and genders. And that's what struck me in the Black Panther thing, to kind of go, oh, that's important to have to normalise the idea of Black heroes for white kids as much as it is to normalize it for Black kids and all
absolutely,
sorts of
absolutely. And that's so important because we all have the idea of who the superheroes are, right? Batman, Superman,
yeah,
and X-Men, and largely they're white.
Yeah.
And so white folks get to have the fantasy world and they get to have the real world.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think what became important about the Black Panther is that black folks, of course, we have our real life superheroes. I think we acknowledge that. But we don't have fantasy superheroes.
Yeah.
And Wakanda is really, you know, superior.
Yeah.
And there's this way in which in your entire life you're being told that you're shit and that your family is shit and your community is shit. You're not going to amount to anything, and that maybe one of you will make it, you know, and then you see this, you know, fantasy world that is just so not fantasy. It's what, and especially in this time where we're living in a country and a world that is dominated by white nationalism,
mm-hmm.
Wakanda becomes a balm.
Yeah.
It becomes a place of refuge.
Yeah.
Almost. And the signature, you know, the crossed arms across the chest becomes this almost like the Black Power fist.
Yeah, completely.
And it's really amazing to witness.
Yeah. And the depth in there as well, the simple level of just, wow, look at this empowering movie, to the level of, I honestly find more and more in there that more and more hidden symbolism mm-hmm. that is amazingly intricate. The fact that, and the simple one to come to mind that only occurred to me ages after, was the last big fight scene takes place on an underground railroad. Exactly. You know, this is the place of so much bloodshed and death of slaves and of slavery. You know, there's so much in there that's an empowering.
And that's all we have statement. To give it up to Ryan Coogler.
Yeah,
you know, young black brother from Oakland, California, who was raised with, you know, learning about the Panther Party, whose first feature film was about Oscar Grant and yeah. Fruitvale Station. He's done really right by us as a community, and I yeah. think he took his time. I remember talking to him while he was filming Black Panther. He was stressed out as hell. He
yeah.
was nervous, you know. He was given all this money from a big studio.
Yeah.
And he delivered. He delivered, and he came through, and you know, obviously he had an entire team, but he was very particular. You yeah. could see the detail to each and every character and delivery and the imagery that he wanted. I mean, it was just so gorgeous.
Yeah, it looked amazing. It was, yeah, a wonderful thing. And it makes me excited with that and with how great Straight Out of Compton was. And
yes.
Because, again, I grew up on Menace to Society, on Boys in the Hood, yes. on Do the Right Thing. Yes. And that was kind of an area that died off. And
yes.
it's exciting now that we could see someone tell the story of the LA riots yes. for the first time in a film, but written by young black people who lived through that
yeah.
rather than by someone who's looking on and going, you know, likely a white executive going, I'm going to write this amazing thing about the black cult. No, it can be completely drawn from reality and experience.
Oh, there's a black renaissance happening right now.
100%.
In the culture. And I, you know, I don't personally take credit for it, but I think Black Lives Matter has contributed to
100%,
the ability yeah. for a black renaissance to actually be popular.
It's pushed a hell of a conversation to the forefront, and we'll get on to part of that conversation because it's a conflicted one. But so the Black Lives Matter, the hashtag was first used by you when George Zimmerman was acquitted of the Trayvon Martin murder. And at first it was just a hashtag and a tweet, and then it gradually moved into becoming a movement. How was that as a realization for you in the moment to be expressing your fury and rage and disgust? And again, it was something that I remember seeing the track that Most Def did about it, and B. Dolan and people like that doing film the police and stuff like that. From this side of the pond, rap and hip hop. And so many different areas of black culture seem to be the ones that were going, we're reporting this.
Yes.
You can't ignore this.
Yes.
This isn't ignorable anymore.
Yeah.
This can't be a chosen or rejected story.
Yeah.
This is being discussed. So how was that to start with a hashtag, essentially, and then to see it grow and develop.
It was amazing, you know. I think Black Lives Matter really, Alicia Garza said the phrase, and I put the hashtag on it, and Opal Tometi came and helped develop the social media platforms to help make it go viral. And then there was other groups like Black Youth Project 100, BYP 100,
yeah,
or the Dream Defenders, who are already doing work on the ground and responding to the acquittal of George Zimmerman or the killing of Trayvon Martin. And then there was, you know, hundreds of Black folks across the country who were galvanized,
yeah,
by the hashtag,
yeah,
and allowed it to go viral. But what's key in this is that Alicia, Opa, and I, we're organizers. We're trained organizers.
Yeah.
And so part of the work was developing the global network, right, that went from a phrase to a hashtag to a political project to an organization.
Completely. And that was the thing that you had, what many movements don't, but you immediately had a set of demands, a list of demands of what you wanted to achieve, yes, and what you wanted, which is the problem a lot of the time with social media politicization, yeah, is that it can be, this isn't acceptable, but no one's making clear grounds on here's what, yeah, we want to do, here's, yeah, the change that we need. Mm-hmm. And you guys brought that. You came straight out with, here's what isn't acceptable, here's the changes, yeah, that we demand. So how was that to become a kind of a galvanizing force, maybe, for a lot of people who wanted to rally but didn't know how to rally or direct their emotions?
It was powerful. I don't think I was going to realize, or any of us going to realize, how big and how much we were going to be needed and how much we were going to be pulled on. I'm a deep believer in decentralized movements and autonomous movements. You know, our network is decentralized. We're autonomous. We're local focused. But our through line is that we're Black folks fighting for Black people to actually matter.
Yeah.
We're Black folks fighting for us to stop being killed by the state.
Yeah.
We're Black folks who are trying to see a future for our children.
Yeah.
And our children's children. And so Black Lives Matter becomes this place where you can figure out how it's going to work in your own town.
Yeah.
In your own city, in your own province, in your own nation. And that felt necessary. I will say in this moment that we've done this, you know, sort of loose autonomous thing for the last 5 years. And I think we're ready for a more organized network.
Yeah.
More clarity on who gets to join and who doesn't. And our next steps, you know, we spent the last 5 years disrupting, using civil disobedience as a tactic to challenge the status quo, challenge white supremacy, white nationalism. But I think we're ready to take on new subjects.
Yeah.
I think we're ready to really delve into electoral politics. Mm-hmm. We don't want to abandon protest. But I think we're ready to see where else this network can take us.
Yeah. And that's absolutely key. The kind of taking more control over that organization and what it is, so that you can have a driven direction and aim, and also so that it's harder for people to disparage what you're doing and, yeah, to say, oh, look, these Black Lives Matter people, they're terrorists, yeah, they're hooligans or whatever else. It's kind of, the more you're taking control over that, the less people can say, oh, but all of this that happened is because of Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm, as well. You can kind of go, well, no, it's not. That isn't our area.
No, that's absolutely right. And yeah, it's been a journey the last 5 years around. I didn't think that. You don't know what's going to happen. You just don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, and of course.
Black Lives Matter was an offering to our movement. And, yeah, folks took it up and used it. And then I think we've seen it be co-opted sometimes or used in ways that we disagree or, and that, we know that our network has been and our movement has been infiltrated. So that becomes an interesting component, especially because that's not what I was prepared for. And I don't think we were collectively prepared for that.
It's a tough one because people, even with the best intentions, are going to have different ideas of how to solve things. Yeah. I'm someone who doesn't think that violence is the answer, but I also don't think that violence has never been the answer and is never the answer. There's so many civil uprisings and changes that have needed violence and bloodshed. Yeah. And to be clear, I'm not saying that we should all go and riot in the streets, but there's points to everything. And if some things aren't working, other things the answer. So it's a tough one from your angle because there will be people who go, right, no, we need to go and smash up this or do this or that. It's like, that's not what you believe in, but it's at points it's a valid reaction or intention. So yeah, it must be a tough one to balance that, the goals and desires of your vision, the way you guys have all set it out, versus people who might want to take it on or have been inspired by it and take it in opposite or different directions.
Yeah, no, that's right.
So I'll start to wrap things up now. One thing that I have to discuss, you know, it became a hobby of mine to argue with people who had issue with the name Black Lives Matter. But I know there was trepidation at the start over it feeling exclusionary as a name. For me, again, it's a ludicrous one. People would regularly respond with White Lives Matter too, and you know, you have to kind of highlight that. What a blessed existence that the first time you feel your life mattering is in question is when a hashtag is put out there, right, on a tweet. It's like that's a pretty blessed life, yeah, if that's the first time you've had that question. Whereas if you've grown up constantly having to question if your life matters, then that's the bigger fight there. So how was that kind of consideration at first of it feeling the risks of it being of feeling exclusionary, but then
I never felt that way, but we did get strong reactions from people inside our movement when we first started coming to them with, okay, so we got this thing called Black Lives Matter, you in? People would be like, well, I don't know if we should be saying black guys.
Sounds a bit much.
That's exactly right. And I was surprised at the people who were like, that's a bit much. Yeah. And so, yeah, Black Lives Matter, we had to organize people around that.
Yeah.
Our own, sometimes you got to organize the choir.
Completely.
And we had to organize the choir. And once the choir got on board, I think it really lifted up why Black Lives Matter was so important. But also, you know, different people try to co-opt Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Like Brown Lives Matter or Muslim Lives Matter or Trans Lives Matter. And what we tried to say is, listen, like, yes, those things are true, but come up with your own thing.
Mm.
And let's have a conversation about the theft of black women's labor.
Yeah.
And why is it so hard to just have something for black people, right? Black Lives Matter is not about exclusion, the phrase. It's about focus.
Completely, completely. And that's what's important at the time. I remember, and I'm sure you've heard it a load of times, but I remember someone doing a post explaining if you're at a dinner table and everyone gets served food and you don't get served food and you go, I'm hungry. And the argument is, well, other people are hungry. Right. It's like, that doesn't stop you being hungry. The issue at that moment is that you're hungry. Exactly. And that's the issue that needs focus. I think one of the greatest problems with so many movements at the moment is the interpretation in people deciding something is saying or want something that it's not, if that makes sense. And you have it in feminism a lot that people go, oh, I'm not a feminist because they want all men to be unemployed or some stupid shit. It's like, no, they don't want that. And so Black Lives Matter, oh, so white lives don't. No, we've not said that. Right. We've said black lives do. We've not said anything other than this. And so you hate all police. So we're not saying that. But, you know, it's these weird assumptions that are put on that aren't put forward by the people who are part of the movement.
Completely.
Put forward by people outside saying, so you think this then? Nah. No, we don't think that. Is the argument over? Because you look really angry. How is that as a kind of, I mean, it must be a constant battle with it being the name of your movement and the kind of action there.
Yeah, it's a constant battle. But I also think what's been curious, and what's been challenging is that we've had people like right-wing pundits like Bill O'Reilly, who's not on air anymore, who chose to go after us.
Yeah.
And really
and fan the flames.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So then this is like, sure, people have feelings about Black Lives Matter, but then you have very powerful people like a Bill O'Reilly who fan the flames and create a narrative about us.
That people won't look any further into.
Precisely. That's
the big problem. That's is the common sense or the common assumption that exactly. You've heard something, therefore I can now go, I'm dying to get angry about
that's
exactly this. Right. I'm dying to be offended, and then they run off on that.
That's exactly right.
So I'll round things up now with what is ahead, because it is a strange one. As we were discussing, I can't remember if it was when we were recording or before we started, but it's a long battle and a long journey and a long war, and that's something I think you've maybe had to resign yourself to early on, that yes. This is a long-term thing. It's not a there will be many battles won along the way, yes. And many moments of achievement, but it's a long-term thing, and it seems a weird one to liken it to, but my mum recently retired, and she worked in libraries her whole life, and particularly in this country, the battle to just keep libraries open is one that's just been going on for ages. And it was only a year or so ago, I kind of said to her, I was like, look, you've been fighting this for 30 years now. Hand it over to someone else.
Yes.
It's not yours to fight anymore. Yes. You know, it's not a battle that you're going to win. They're not going to, before you retire, go, okay, well, we've agreed we will never close libraries. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So it is one of them fights that is going to be ongoing, may outlive you, if that makes sense.
So, and yes, and we are preparing to train the next generation of leaders so that we don't have a gap in leadership development around this movement. And I know that most of the things that I'm fighting for aren't going to happen in my lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. So it's number one, the act of fighting for them is the important part.
Yes.
The winning in the end is important, but there's so many things that it's the act of standing up and going into that battle is more important than simply if you're going to win or lose. A lot of people argue, particularly in politics, oh, but they could never win or they could never get in. Yeah. And sometimes it's not about that. It's about the fact that that's what should be being stood for.
Precisely.
And what should be being argued.
That's exactly right. I wouldn't, if I, the clock were, you know, dialed back, I would not change, make it a hashtag 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, perfect. Well, thank you very much. Where can people keep up to date on everything that you're doing and all that is ahead?
BlackLivesMatter.com. I have my own website, patricecolors.com, and follow us at BLK Lives Matter on Instagram and on Twitter. And I'm at OSOPEPATRISSE on Instagram and Twitter.
Perfect. And so, I mean, I read your book, When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir, from Christmas Eve to about January 2nd or 3rd.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I can't urge people enough to go and read this, because it's not, the key part of the book is it's not simply for people who are on board with Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
It's for people who don't understand, for people that are against it or question it, to get a full story. I think it's fine to be against something if you've got the full fucking story. But if you're just going against it without without having done the legwork, then it's a senseless argument. So urge people to go and read that. And thank you very much for giving me your time.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobish Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. I hope you enjoyed that. And I think a few of you will be surprised at what a warm and lovely person you just heard. Because, as I said, there is this image of a militant approach and an anger and an aggression. But, I think she's an amazing woman with a great outlook. One thing that I felt afterwards, because we were discussing as I was packing away, one thing that I felt afterwards might not have come across too clearly was when she was saying about the slight annoyance of people taking on the Black Lives Matter, kind of taking on the name and making it Trans Lives Matter and Brown Lives Matter and all these different things. It's not a pettiness of that's our idea. It's a dilution, and it's diluting, or it seems to put these things at odds, which they're not. The Black Lives Matter movement, if you read her book, was very much led by the LGBT community. It was queer black women who were making this stance and movement. So it's not an anti any of these things. It's just, if you all start to take that, it starts to seem as if they're conflicting. So we say Black Lives Matter. Well, we say Brown Lives Matter. Well, we say, and you know what I mean? And that's not the point of the Black Lives Matter movement. As you said, it kind of almost becomes as acidine as All Lives Matter and that kind of thing. So yeah, I think that was the point there. And I thought it'd be good to clarify that here, because as I said, we only had an hour and we were trying to cram so much in. It was like talk, let's move on to this, let's move on to that. So yeah, it was more that, and the idea that the trans movement or the LGBT community in general need an equal amount of support. And you know, if you know anything about the history of protest, that you'll know that when the LGBT community stood with the miners striking in the UK, it's what got the success. It was these two completely different worlds, but both who were being repressed, who stood together. But it was in support of a movement rather than it seeming like in conflict against a movement. So yeah, I wanted to clarify that to you, and I have done that now. I will be back next week. As said, we got a hardcore listing special. It's a two-part. I'll put them out in the same day because it's a top five. So normally when there's a two-parter, I'll put them out on separate days or whatever, but it's a top five, and it's top five songs that make me cry. And by the end of the first half, we've started to weep a little bit. I also drunk gin, you know, mother's a ruin. So I don't know. It felt like a really strong and important episode, that it's three at times blokey blokes sitting in what literally is regularly described as a man cave, having a good cry and having no shame about it, and kind of celebrating the idea of sensitivity. So yeah, that's a cool one. It's out next week. I'm trying to secure a bonus one for the Friday, because a friend of mine and a friend of the podcast has a film out that I think is one of the films of the year, and I want to just talk to him about it and support it. But we're trying to, it's schedules. But the week after that, we'll definitely have Alan Hughes and Jimmy Iovine. And yeah, I've told you all that's coming up. Also, the club night. It's We Are Lizards month. So I'll be at the book club on the 31st of March. We've got Block Party coming down to DJ. I'll be DJing. We've actually grabbed an extra hour, so we'll be open till 3 partying with you lot. I'm always there from like 8 o'clock. So the earlier you come down, the more I'll be happy to chat, have photos, sign stuff, kick it with you lot. The later you come down, the busier it gets, the more drunk I am, the more I'm kind of just up for putting on my rubber lizard mask and playing music to you. If you're new to this podcast or me, you should know that I DJ in a rubber lizard mask. So, but yeah, that's what's to come. The book club, We Are Lizards, March 31st. Come on down to that. I'll see you all soon. And there's a lot of podcasts to come. So I'll see you all soon, and have a good week. Hope you enjoyed this chat. As I kind of had to put a thing, or I'm going to put a thing on the social media posts about it, requesting that people don't get into discussion until they've listened to the podcast, because it's one of those things that it's fine to have an opinion, but it annoys me when people want to chime in on something before they've actually listened to it. Debate should be as much about hearing and educating yourself as it is about spouting your own opinion. Harlan Ellison said, you are not entitled to your own opinion. You are entitled to your own informed opinion. No one is entitled to be ignorant. So that's kind of the theme on the social media post. Obviously, you're at the end of the podcast now. You've had a listen. Feel free to go in and have a chat, have a debate. Keep it friendly and keep it clean, guys. Let's all be nice out there. And yeah, get the book. Or When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. I'll see you all next week. Have a good one. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.